Hello, this is Shay Comfort, the Yeast Whisperer from the Bay Area, California, and you are listening to Cider Chat.
Episode number 73. Hello and welcome to Cider Chat. My name is Rhea Winkoller, and I am your Cider MC and the producer of this weekly podcast where we chat with cider makers, enthusiasts, and folks within the cider trade from around the world. And this week, we are speaking with Shay Comfort, aka the Yeast Whisperer. There'll be more on that chat in just a moment. Well, Ciderville, it's been a week since I have spoken with you, and that means that last week I had to skip an episode. I was wrestling with the beast called the flu, and that is not fun at all. Man, I was kind of tossing and turning. Oh, yoy. It's been a while since I've been that sick. And, you know, when you're that sick, you're kind of like, you can't eat, you know, you're just sipping water. But I do want to say one of the things that I found kind of like a comfort food for me and kind of clearing the palate were some slices of apples. And just to kind of like have that savory taste present just made everything that much better when it was just so tough. And I thought, I'll never get through this. But I did. And I'm actually still kind of holding on to it a little bit. You might hear that in my voice as such things happen. It takes a while to recover. But indeed, I am. And I am thankful for that. So as I say, an apple a day can keep the doctor away or certainly get your palate back on track. So we're going to jump right into it this week because we have a really fun show and it's about yeast. And so why don't we go directly to a question that came to me or to the Cider Chat Facebook page last week from Jerry. And Jerry asked, can you start a cider with instant yeast? Or do you need a special kind of yeast to make cider? He writes that he's starting a new experiment and is, asking this kind of, not too unrealistic question. In fact, Jerry, when I was first starting out fermenting, I had the same thought, why not just use what I consider instant yeast being what you might get like a Fleischmann's bread yeast. And for those of you who don't know what Fleischmann's, and that's a brand name. And it's like an instant yeast. You could get like a dry active yeast just in your grocery market. These little packages of like a tablespoon of dry active yeast. And the word on the street was don't do that because each yeast has different profiles. And that's a bit about what we're going to be talking with Shay this week. But I have a kind of rather informative story about this. See, way back when I was starting out, and you might have heard me talking about Valley Fermenters. It's a group based in Western Massachusetts. It's kind of like the oldest home brewing fermentable group in the country, from what I know, started way back. And there was this woman called Sophia, and she made the most terrific tomato wine. Now, as you might know, tomato is not a vegetable. It's actually a fruit. So she made a fruit wine out of tomato. And I even brought one of these bottles of tomato to Italy years back. And wow, the Italians just went crazy over it. It kind of comes out a little bit like a sherry. And the one that Sophia made just kind of knocked my socks off. So she relented. Back then, at that time, she was 80 and she lived into her 90s. And she said, okay, Rhea, I'll give you this recipe, but you have to follow it exactly. So, okay, I'm going to follow this recipe exactly. I take it home, I look at it, and it says dry active yeast, like a bread yeast. And, I'm thinking, oh, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to be kind of like a little bit of a wine snob, and I'm going to go out and get some kind of like champagne yeast, just a dry wine yeast at my local homebrew shop, which I did. I made it, and the wine was not good. Tomato wine wasn't good at all. So I went back to the drawing board and talked to Sophie about it. She said, you need to follow this recipe exactly. And this time I did, and I used that bread yeast. And I don't know what it was about that, because I still don't fully get the depth of yeast in that way. But that wine came out a winner. In fact, it won a first place award. So there you go, Jerry. You just never know. It has to kind of fit the right profile. And the thing about yeast, and nowadays, certainly with yeast that we use for fermentables and in terms of libations, you could get these whole scripts on exactly the specs behind the yeast and what you could expect out of that yeast, whether it's going to throw off a lot of SO2, or whether it's going to leave residual sugars, a lot of that. So you'll be able to see some of the links on the show notes for this episode number 73 to some of the manufacturers that are offering the manuals behind yeast. But my story, I don't think it's really unique. And I learned a big lesson today. One is when this old Polish woman gave me that recipe, follow it. Don't get all snobby. There was a reason why she was winning first place awards with this wine. And then I did too. I don't know what it is. It's just sometimes the magic of it all. And that yeast are very peculiar beings. And they have many different properties. And who knows what you're going to find out with cider. So Jerry is going to try it. And we hope to hear back from him how he liked it. Truthfully, I wouldn't do it with apples. I just don't think it's the right blend. And when there's so many other choices out there, why use your precious juice that you work so hard for with this kind of unknown variable such as a bread yeast? I don't think you're going to get the same properties out of it. But who knows? Maybe Jerry will have his luck. And who am I to judge? And I think that's the excitement of fermenting in general, is that the sky's the limit. And I think this was perfect timing because of this week's chat with Shea Comfort. So go for it, Jerry. We want to hear from you. And that tomato wine. Wow. If you make tomato wine, let me know. I'm kind of curious if you make it with a bread yeast. And of course, there's a couple other secret ingredients in this particular tomato wine recipe. I've been sitting on it for a while. I think what I'm going to do, I'm going to put it up on the Cider Chat Patreon page and pass it along to the patrons there who have been so supportive of this chat as a little thank you. And if you want to get involved too on Patreon and help this chat continue to thrive, well, it's really easy to do. Just find the links to that on the show notes, or just Google Patreon, Patreon, Cider Chat. And we'll get that tomato wine recipe up there and see if you could try your hand on it and maybe get your own first place prize too. Tons of fun in the fermentable land. All right, let's next go to the Facebook page one more time and just welcome some of the new folks who have stepped through that portal and joined in on the conversation. And the first spot in Ciderville that we want to welcome folks from is Portugal. And that's both Luis and Manuel. And they probably know that there is a cidery in Portugal. It's the first, you know, public cidery since who knows when. And if you want to hear more about that, that was episode 69 with Marlene Sofia Sousa Arouge. And that was a really interesting chat. So I'm not going to say more about it. I'm sure you guys know about it, Luis, Manuel. But if the rest of you out there in Ciderville haven't heard that chat, you should, because it was very, very informative. And partially, it was bilingual. Then we also have Kaori, and I believe she is from Japan. And then Matthew, I'm not sure where you're from, but I see that on your cover photo you have like a 70s era VW bus. And having had about three of those buses, I think, myself, what I found was the lovely thing about a VW is that children wave and adults smile when you go by. And that's a nice energy to put out in the world. Then we have Zandy from Colorado. I'm sure you're hot on the trail there in the cider scene that's bustling and booming in Colorado. And Marco in Italy, welcome. There's some delicious, fantastically delicious ciders coming out of Italy. Can't wait to get to some of the cider makers there. That's been hot on my list there. And then we have Jamie from New York. She is a bartender and co-owner at Joey's, which is in Rochester, New York. That's a bar. Matt is from Chicago. Cool scene there. We did a number of shows. In fact, this show was recorded while I was in Chicago at CiderCon. And certainly there is a cider bar there, the Northman. You want to check that out? I had Brian Ritson on episode 65. Then we have Paul from Denmark and also Christopher from Denmark too. And Christopher writes on his profile that he's part of the cider revolution or a cider revolutionaire. I like that. Yeah, we got to be a little revolutionary and get out and, you know, otherwise how people are going to hear about cider if we're just kind of sitting on our own laurels and waiting to be discovered. Then there's Carrie from the great state of Rhode Island. It's an ocean state. You know, Rhode Island's one of New England's best kept secrets. People don't, you know, think of it as a destination in some ways, but of course there's Newport, Rhode Island, hotspot. Providence is a wonderful scene. Good folks down there, and there's cider happening. Then we also have Brian from California. I see, Brian, that you're into food and libations. I love California. And welcome to William from Boston. And Brian, who is part of the Aeronaut Brewing Company in Somerville, Massachusetts, my home state. And then there's WSU Fermentation, and WSU stands for Washington State University. And that university now has a fermentation program that they've been putting out there. They have a Facebook page too, so if you want to check that out, do, because there's some great ciders being made in Washington State. It's a huge producer of apples, and certainly any university that's putting out teachings on how to become a better fermenter is a friend of mine. All right, that's it from now. We went around the world in like 60 seconds or more, and it just blows me out of the water to see all these cool folks joining in on the conversation. So don't be shy. This is a open page to you, and hope you could join too at the Cider Chat Facebook page. Okay, I think it's time that we head over to the main chat on this week's episode number 73. This is about yeast, so it might feel a little bit technical, and certainly Shay loves to go full in on it. So we've really put him to task as I tried to have him hone it down and give us some solid tips that you could use no matter what level of the fermentable skill spectrum you are. So let's now grab a glass and join this chat with Shea Comfort, the Yeast Whisperer from California. Shay, welcome to Cider Chat.
Hello.
Really, really stoked to have you on because I know that we're here recording this at the Chicago CiderCon. Mm-hmm. And earlier today, Shay was doing a talk that was totally packed on what you do with yeast. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the kind of like trifectas of cider making is, you know, yeast, how it comes in with the fruit and the skills of the cider maker and it's like this little mystery. People like plop it into the cider, but they don't really understand it, I suspect. Or maybe you could kind of like give us a little background on that, because you've been doing this for a while, and I'd like to start there. Give folks out in Ciderville an idea of what your background is and how you became the Yeast Whisperer. Which I love that title. It's so perfect.
Those who know me, I actually, that was given to me And I did not, I would not have chose that myself. I'm a bit more reserved, believe it or not, in certain situations and in, kind of strange. I basically started out as a homebrew person 20-something years ago and got hooked on that. Did a whole series of things on mead, and then kind of got into a situation where there was friends of mine who were just starting up a pretty big homebrew supply shop, and they had done a lot of innovation and things around the brewing side of things, and people were asking, when are you going to do that for the wine side of things? And they just were so slammed, a really small company, and basically they asked me, you know, do you want to do some of that work and help us, you know, flush that out on the side. And I said, absolutely, you know, because you seem to like it, you know, we'll give you the stuff, you can do it. But you just have to then disseminate that information back into the internet for the company, et cetera, and go from there. Because if you want it, then other customers are going to want it, was the concept.
Did you have a science background that would kind of lend itself towards this? Or
You're
a homebrewer, but I mean that.
Right. No, no. Well, my university degree is in history of art and philosophy.
I'm sure the yeast appreciate that.
Yeah. But my mind, I'm definitely an artist first and foremost, but I'm also very conscious of you need tools to do the job. And so part of this 3-year process of me figuring out the winemaking things and actually being introduced from the amateur side of the world and into actual proper professional winemaking sides was the very first thing when I got introduced to it was I noticed that here's a catalog of products, not just yeast, but I mean products and things that are available and techniques and things that are being referenced that I had no idea existed. Nobody in the amateur world knew that any of these things existed. And it kind of was intimidating, but also kind of blew my mind. And then I stopped and I said, why, if all this is part of standard winemaking, why isn't any of this, you know, being brought back to the amateur market? What's going on here? And so I brought that back to the guys at the, you know, back then it was just more beer, you know, more beer, more wine guys. And they said, well, find out about it. Because, I mean, if you want to know, someone else is going to know. And this is probably what we're looking at for expanding that. So over 3 years, I did a whole, and I was allowed to, which is pretty, pretty great. Yeast trials first, bacteria trials following the yeast trials the next year, and then different oaks and different tannins and different handling procedures after that. By the third year of doing these trials, just to learn and putting that information out on the website and then finding out about products, bringing them in, using them, and then we made them available, you know, through the shop. So I was kind of pay by play. Mm-hmm. The more you talk to everyone, the more you realize that there's a level of science and there's a level of technical awareness that was just completely part and parcel with all of the professional stuff, period. And you become aware of that, like, huh, okay. And then I started exhausting, first couple months I exhausted all of the amateur books that were there, and there was, the information was just pretty meager at best. You know, anything from like, oh, just stomp on the grapes and have fun, you know what I mean, and just not enough at all whatsoever, and just kind of really just acceptable for, you know, generalizations I thought were not going to really help anyone. And the archy opposite of that is when you look at, you know, catalogs and talk to these other people, and they are just, I mean, we're doing trials, we're doing products, we're doing this, fine-tuning this, awarenesses of this, things to fix this and that I don't even know are potentially going to be, you know, could be problems or not problems. Mm-hmm. And everything was very clear and very rich and available. So it became pretty apparent to me fairly quickly that if you want to become confident in this and learn more and go deeper about this, you had to have an understanding of the science, because after I passed through all the amateur books, then what was passed to me was, you should probably look at, then I went through the UC Davis principles and practices, and then there's the Bourdieu's book from Handbook of Enology 1 and 2 from in France, so which two-volume series that just in-depth, beautiful, phenomenal, you know, just high-end, beautiful winemaking text. I I work through all of those.
Can you repeat the name of the author for that text there?
Du Bourdieu.
It's a French name.
Yeah, okay. There's three main guys. Okay. They're from Bordeaux.
Okay.
So it's basically the... Yeah, it's kind of a standard... translated to English.
Oh, that's great.
But it's from French, mm-hmm. obviously, mm-hmm. and it's probably one of the more practical ones compared to... Because my thing against the Davis book was that, you know, you don't need any... you know, how many spider graphs do I need of stuff to learn how it's fascinating, it is interesting, but how do I actually use that mm-hmm. information? And then most of the Handbook of Enology ones had very clear ways, their science was there, but it's very clear applicable. That being said, there's a whole set of information in the other one that wasn't in the other, you know. So there's usually 20% in each book that's pure gold, that's unique, and there's overall overlapping coverage in general. So mm-hmm. once you find out about that and learn about that, you realize you have to get some sort of competency in science. You know, basic formulas, concepts, ideas, and just get used to it, you know, and it's critical. But that being said, I think there's a trap where many winemakers, you can be really good with science and be really good with the numbers and everything else and still make average wine. Technically correct, sterile, not interesting. And then usually the argument is like, well, I don't want to get too, I'm an artist, I want to go by, you know, the feel and the taste and have that be that. And that's truly where art is done, you know, et cetera. And yes, artists will approach in a way that's good. But the problem is, as soon as you have some sort of deviation in fruit or the year or something else pops up, because it's biology and it's basically full of, you know, traps and issues and it's incredibly complex. And just because everything worked for the last 5 years doing what you did doesn't mean it will work this year. Have a problem that you never knew about, and welcome to the world of learning about some other organism or some other factor, right? Mm-hmm. And so the pure artistic approach is great until it's not.
Well,
you know?
So,
And so for me, what's the most appealing thing about any forms of winemaking, and cider is wine, is that you have to have a technical background to be able to do the tools, but to, you know, give you, artist has to have brushes to paint, and so the science are the literal brushes and the canvas and the palette work and the palette knife, etc. You have to have tools, and science are those tools. Mm-hmm. But just because you have the tools doesn't make you make great art. So that's your foundation you look at, and then from there the trick is to have those be your tools, and then to be able to then understand what's going on from there, and then be able to actually do the art. Right. And so you have to have it. It's a necessary thing mm-hmm. for those who are not. Who don't tend towards that mm-hmm. by their nature if they want to do it. And so that's the beauty of it, is it covers both sides of the brain.
And when did this path start for you?
So homebrewing was the first shot from there.
Three years. What was the timeline?
96, 95, okay. Something like this.
So you've been in it for quite a while then.
Oh, I've been fermenting for probably over 20 years now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you're doing this work, and you have a website that we'll have in the show notes, our links to that.
Yeah.
And you probably have seen the wide scope of what's going out there in the world. I'm kind of curious, what do you see with what was happening with cider back when you started in the late 90s?
Well, nothing.
And now, today.
So to me, the awareness was cider wasn't even registering on my mind back then, because I'm also fairly myopic and focused. And so basically going from the brewing and going to the wine side, really involving the wine side of things and being able to work on that for years doing experiments, and then actually going and starting a small winery with somebody, and then going to other things. And then when that fell apart, because that's a complete hilarious, and if by hilarious I mean shit show, you know, getting all kind of a story. But anyhow, without naming names, that was probably one of the worst situations to get into. But I wanted to see, how do you translate from carboy small stuff to actual proper winery, you know?
Sure.
And good news, everything did scale. And at that following show, there's a big unified wine and grape symposium that happens in Sacramento in January. Oh. The 2 weeks that was before this one, for CiderCon. And was there for there, and people going, hey, how's the new winery going? How's everything? I go, it's not. They're like, what are you talking about? I said, well, no, it just completely fell apart. They go, that's ridiculous. I go, I'm looking for a job, guys. You know, and they said, like, you know, do you know of anybody? You know, I need a job. I'm on the dole. You know?
That's 2 weeks ago. We're talking.
No. Okay, this is okay. back. This back is probably back. Seven, yeah. seven, like, seven, okay. no, 7 or 8 years ago.
Okay, good. All
right. Yeah. So I did wine moment for a long, long time.
Yeah.
And it was looking, you know, for a job. To a T, people said, like, you don't want to go to a place because that's not what you do. Mm. You have all this trials and all this stuff. You've got all this time to figure stuff out and work on things that people don't get a chance to do. Like, that's what you should do. I go, like, oh, I'm nobody. I have a degree in history and philosophy. I didn't go to Davis. You know, nobody's gonna give you the time of day. They go, yeah, but you just have to open your mouth and pour something for them, and it's clear. I go, yeah, but who? How am I gonna do this? Mm. So this went on in the show. And then they said, yeah, you're like a yeast whisperer. And I was like, yeah, whatever. You know, and I just kind of flew by that. I go, that's cheesy. Like, I want to be taken seriously, right? The third day, the third person said that to me literally in 3 days in a row. And I went, okay. And I went, okay, I got it. Universe, I got it. So that's how that came around.
Wow. Well, that was destiny.
So wine went for a while. I was doing consulting for wine and stuff. And then at some point... doing a lot of trials with, basically I was doing trials for Lalamon during this whole entire time, yeast and bacteria trials, and that's how I was learning as a side benefit. And at one point, they started having me come and pour things, and then they started sending me out to give technical fermentation talks on their behalf, since I basically cut my teeth using their stuff, and they saw it and they appreciated it, and now I work with them. So over time, the cider thing popped up as a show that came up saying, like, oh, there's this thing with, you know, cider. And I had just spent the previous year and a half doing berry wines with an Alaskan winery up in Soldotna. And so everything I knew from winemaking, everything from there, was slightly different but the same for the berries. And the differences were lack of structure in some ways and that kind of thing. So all the puzzles that were posited there were different than from grape wines, which are different from the beer stuff. Mm-hmm. So I'd already kind of cut my teeth and was preparing, even though I didn't know that. And then right after that, the first kind of cider thing popped up to go talk, and I came and was tasting things, but I went, oh, this is all of these things that I've done in the past all combined in one thing.
Perfect.
And that was 6 years ago.
Wow.
And that was, it's the most technically difficult product I know to translate an apple to a glass, and it's taken everything I know from the past 20 years of going from brewing to mead making to aromatic whites to, you know, Pinot, to all the approach of these things, berries, all the berries and the non-traditional fruits combined together to make a good cider. So literally it took me that long to be able to be here in a way that I could actually help people.
So when you're going out and helping people, what is there something that's kind of a glaring pop-up that says, whoa, if most cider makers knew this, they would have a lot more success with that fermentation or that final product?
Yes. I bristle at when people say, you know, we're cider, you know, we're not beer, we're not wine, we're cider. And I'm like, no, you are not. You are wine. You are the most beautiful white wine, classic making thing that is of a transition of fruit that's possible. You know, and that's really where you should be thinking about it, and it's really what you need to be able to do. And this approach of that, I think, is actually doing more of a disservice otherwise, because it's taking away the focus from the work that needs to be done. And for me, when I taste apples off trees, like I jumped in and did a cidery with somebody after I spoke my third year, the third CiderCon, and it was the beginning of that was a fantastic collaboration. And then the money guy basically screwed both of us, so that didn't work. But the short of it is that I got exposure to my first shot of walking up, it's basically Brooke Schmidt and the Schmidt family farm up in Boonville. And my first exposure to walking through an orchard and tasting 12 different varieties of apples that had acid and tannins and structure and that were worth a shit. And it blew my mind. And it was so galvanizing and so beautiful. I'm like, why aren't these in the stores for eating? Because they're unbelievably balanced and amazing. What are these crap apples that we have, you know, for lunches and stuff that are terrible, you know? And then where is all this power and flavor and aroma coming? And that was it, you know? And so being able to work and understand that was absolutely tremendous. And so for me, and then inherently everything in me vibrated. I knew that everything I talked about before from the winemaking point of view, understanding acidity, balance, and structure, and minerality, and skin fractions, and perfume, all of these things, these are winemaking approaches to things. They have to be part of cider. You know, they have to be part. Blending is part of it. Whether you're blending apples in the beginning, whether you're dealing with multiple strains of yeast, which is what I advocate, and then put together, you know, if you have the apples to blend, fantastic. If you don't, you know, no matter what strength, put them back together for reasons, complexity, balance, interesting things going on there, reinforcement of what's already there. If the apples are lovely, mm-hmm. helping the apples if they're a little bit not the most exciting, mm-hmm. you know, and that has to be there. And I find like most people are the two main faults besides, you know, sanitary and a lack of kind of winemaking understanding as far as a lot of lactic spoilage and a lot of acidic problems and a lot of things that I don't think they were shooting for. You know, and they wind up happening a lot. The main thing is you have a lot of insipid, boring ciders with usually too much residual sweetness on the back end, mm-hmm. you know, for the straight ones. That's the big thing for me as a problem. And so understanding that you can really get amazing complexity, even if things are dry from mm-hmm. proper strain selection, I think is mm-hmm. critical. Mm-hmm. I mean, I do what I preach, and I've done it for 20 years, so I know it. And it translates to meads, to fruit wines, to ciders. I mean, fruit and the berries and stone fruits, you know, ciders in addition to the grapes. So it's being consistent. It's not like it's not proven or I don't know. It's like it's guaranteed. And every single person that I go through this with, they just shake their heads going, I knew you said that, but it didn't really resonate. They didn't grok it, you know, in the sense. And so you can put it in their mouth and they smell it. And, you know, there's no one yeast is as good as one or two or three combinations, the right ones put together. And that blows people's minds. And it doesn't change that much work of what you're doing. So that awareness of that, I think, is probably one of the most critical. That don't accept that you just have to add sugar until it's balanced in the back end, because you have just dumbed down what was really nice there. Because as soon mm-hmm. it's so fast on the residual sugar additions, mm-hmm. it's so fast to lose the skin fractions mm-hmm. and the minerality. It's amazing how quickly that disappears.
So how do you manage that? As a cider maker, mm-hmm. Do you call folks cider makers, or do you call everyone winemakers?
No, cider makers.
So how does that fit in the difference there? I mean, because you're saying cider is a wine, mm-hmm. so should we call it cider?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a wine made from apples.
Wine made from apples. Done. So that's how you would explain cider.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm going to give you really kind of like baseline, sure, of course.
Technically, Perry is, you know, a pear cider, but so I know I get into that. So when it's pears, I do call it Perry, even though technically it's a pear cider.
Oh, how's so that? How's it Perry a pear cider? Because most people say Perry, a pear cider.
Well,
pear juice added to apple.
No, a Perry is any kind of cider made from pears.
Cider making pears, right?
Yeah, making pears.
A pear that is well suited for.
Regardless if it's suited or not, I mean, if it's fermented and it's from a pear, it's a Perry.
Correct.
The pear based, yeah. And so for me, when I'll say, you know, Perry for, you know, I'll say that for if it's pear based, and I'll say cider. When I say ciders, I usually mean apple based.
It just gets a little confusing when you call it Perry pear cider.
Yeah.
You know, that's a nomenclature kind of really screws this
which is
industry
true.
Big time, well, you know, because it's like all over the map.
Right, and that's the funny, and I'm sure my peculiarities on that are going to be different than what theoretically is considered standard somewhere else, and that's just part of...
I like hearing what you say.
Well, it's a little bit of the Wild West mentality of what's going on.
Let's say, hell yeah, you know, but that's the best part of it.
Yeah, maybe, yeah.
You know, nothing wrong with embracing that because, you know, it's an open book. We create the culture we want at this point, at least in the U.S., not in the rest of the world.
So I'm not quite sure I answered your question then, did I?
It, it's okay. I think we went around it. I want to get into some more other stuff.
Okay.
I'm going to give you like a for instance, and because there's people here listening in Ciderville who are thinking, no, I just want to understand my basic like home cider making technique.
Yeah.
You know, I get the juice from the cider mill, the fresh pressed juice. I, you know, what do I do with that yeast? I have like a liquid yeast, I have dry yeast.
There's no difference.
How do I approach that? And should I be spending premium money for a liquid yeast? Or, you know, what is the approach there that people do, you know?
So I'm actually really good friends with liquid yeast manufacturers, but all of my work is done, and my true family are dried yeast manufacturers. And that from, because people who know me, you know, they, you know, so the funny part to me is that most brewers are using liquid yeast cultures, which I never quite got. And then most winemakers.
When you say brewers, like at a brewery.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Most of those are those.
Yeah.
But the large part,
right.
A lot of liquid slurries.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is about, there's, if done well, within their time frames of viability, there should be no difference between a liquid culture and a dry culture. Okay. The only thing is that there's certain conveniences of dried culture, because you can have a dried yeast, you know, be in a, you know, fridge and sealed up like this, you know, and have viability for, you know, 2 to 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Liquid culture, you're dealing with maybe a month or some change like that,
right.
Until where things start to kind of degrade and, you know, go down a little bit like this too.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, as far as availability is concerned, as far as selection possibilities, you know, when you're looking at to ramp up production for a dry yeast production, you have to have so many millions of tons and blah, 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 blah. So you're going to have a little bit more of less possibility to have some kind of esoteric small strain be able to crank out towards a liquid culture.
Mm-hmm.
You can just build that up and crank it up to a certain size and then off it goes. So there's a lot more of not elasticity, but reactivity, or kind of more fluidity of what's potentially you can get out there as far as options on the liquid side. I'd say that there's that's where you could say there'd be a benefit of liquid over that. But for the most part, if they're done right, they should be the same. That's the way I look at it.
So a lot of questions I get from me, you know, taught cider making for 16, 17 years.
Yeah.
What kind of yeast should I use? What kind of, you know, the first time person coming in making cider, looking at like a dry yeast, probably a good place to start. The palate that doesn't really want it to be like super, super sweet with like residual sugars or anything like that. And how does that person approach that? I know this is like kind of like we're really kind of like bringing it down that novice level.
No, I don't
mind
that at all.
But a lot of cider makers, commercial cider makers,
well,
have that same question.
Well, yeah, I know. Trust me.
I'm sure you do.
Job security.
I'm sure you do.
No, and I don't. I have no. There's what you were seeing. Why you made that comment was me filtering through two or three things. Had nothing to do with a value. Projected thing of what you were saying at all.
Yeah.
It was more, I was kind of bristling a little bit, and I really hate, this is a, you know, a sweet meat yeast or a sweet cider yeast. And all I hear about that is that under normal circumstances, it's a yeast that will probably be a little bit weaker, not quite as robust. Okay, fair enough.
But that's where they're classifying it too, like both it's or at the homebrew shops.
Again, that's the lack of sophistication and technical awareness, you know, not being funneled through from a professional set of information to the amateur level.
Mm-hmm.
And why I say this is because you can take a sweet mead yeast, and if you basically, you know, take it and you do, you're doing nutrients and you're doing something like this too, you can get it well past its stated dryness level. You know, it's a little bit slower and not quite as much as some of the other ones would do, but you can do it. So the ranges, my big thing was like I was doing a corn mash thing, and I took basically a British, you know, British dry, whatever, and I think from White Labs, and I think, you know, Mike told me it was something like, you know, it was Chris or Mike, and they were saying like, on paper, the attenuation was something like 8% alcohol or something. That's what it was supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I basically took 1090 starting gravity to zero with this yeast.
and then was like classified as a sweet mead yeast.
Well, just like classified that. As like, you know, standard. It would poop out somewhere around, you know, 7% or whatever it was.
Right.
You know, and I got it up, you know, around 9 or 10.
Is that
because of nutrients?
That you work a lot with nutrients.
Well, my point is that how you handle the fermentation has a direct effect on the performance of the yeast. So in general, if you're saying to me, and then quite honestly, when you're looking at, I mean, ciders, the alcohol level is nothing, 6 or 7%. Pretty much everything is going to do really well there, unless you're dealing with some ale yeast. You know, even then, I don't think those esters, unless you're going for that kind of boozy British style, you know, that type of flavor profile that it's producing, I don't think it's really conducive to just clean apples for me. You know what I mean? I'm not a big phenolic fan. I'm not a big, you know, kind of that boozy quality fan. That's not my thing.
Sure.
You know, so then the problem is that most of those yeasts with that level of alcohol are going to have no problem whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
Nutrients are not, you know, you know, that kind of a thing. So that's not the level. So choosing something based on theoretically it's supposed to be a sweetness of this. Do you realize the sweetness of this is coming from mead and from wines, which you're dealing with 12 to 14% alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
We're dealing with 6 or 7.
Right.
You know, no wine yeast, quote unquote wine yeast, would have an issue with that whatsoever, period.
So any wine
understand what you're going into and where those characterizations are coming from. You know, what is that rated for? In what environment? What must is it going into? And what does that mean, sugar-wise? And is that what you have? You know, because if you don't have that, that's not applicable to your situation, and it might behave not like how you.
Most people have like a three gallon carboy. Sometimes it's plastic.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's glass.
Yeah.
They might be doing it in an apartment dwelling.
But that has nothing to do with what I just said.
But they're walking into the store
saying,
"What do I do?
I know.
What do I do? So how do they uncomplicate that? They just go for a wine yeast and.
Well, what I would that's the other thing. So you're noticing you ask a simple question, and you notice that I've got this like fractured, like a prism. You give me white light, and I split it to a rainbow.
Oh, yeah, I'm definitely noticing that. Okay.
My thing would be, what white wine yeast would reinforce apples from its ester profile?
Yeah, what wine yeast does reinforce apples?
I'd say a default would be any of the Champagne strains of DV10. I think it's and that would be a start, not the end,
right.
But a start. Mm-hmm. And the reason why is because most people find 118, EC118, you know, available. But what I don't like about that is it's a bit more linear, and it throws a lot of sulfur. And we already have enough reduction issues already happening in apple fermentations. And
so I
kind of kick him to the curb. And then what I like about DV10 is it's a bit more elegant, it's a bit more round, and a bit more, it still stays true to the existing apple. It does not help with fullness, mouthfeel, aroundness. It does not make things more pretty and aromatic and beautiful and give it a nice, you know, glow and some other things and kind of enhance anything, really. There's a little bit, but not really that much.
Yeah.
It stays really true to your original fruit. So as a default, that's probably a good way to go.
Okay.
You know, and this, and if you're going to try two things side by side, I always use, in any trial whatsoever, I always have DB10 as a benchmark.
Now, in your talk, I thought you made a great point, is that really learn to be true to that apple, essentially, instead of like, you know, what I see and what I've seen over the pattern of cider making over the past 20 years is that people really are coming in now, and we're having this like whole bevy of different styles within, you know, different fruit, ciders.
Hops
with
and
add-ons.
Ginger.
Yeah, hops, ginger, I mean, banana. I mean, you know, I've done all that too, you know, because the apple's really inviting. But
people who know me know, I'll be the first one to say, like, you know, kind of roll my eyes, you know, at some of the other adjuncts. It's coming from a deeper place than just as a guilty pleasure. I mean, for me, the...
Is there a little bit of a guilty pleasure there, though?
Only
the calling it for
only,
what it is.
No.
Okay.
Only in the following circumstance.
Yeah.
So my analogy is, okay, if you paint a red square on a white canvas and you call it art, it's not art unless you can figure draw, you can perspective draw, you know, color blending, if you know all these things, and then you still choose to put a red square on a white canvas as an artistic choice, that's a valid artistic choice. If it's all you know how to do and you just crank it up because it's something like this too, and you're to call it art, man, you know, like, no, that's bullshit.
Right.
I'm sorry. No.
Is that
not,
how
it's not
Yoko
that.
Ono got away with that on her little, like...
Well, I mean, you got to give her gusto for hanging in there with, like, ridiculous stuff.
She got John Lennon out of it, so then not that.
So in my mind, I look at this saying, like, I actually don't mind if someone's going to work with hops or herbs or spices or fruits and stuff. I don't. But you have to, it has to be done in a style that's balanced and that's beautiful and where the apple is still present.
Yeah.
It's an equal conversation.
Right.
And so it's like saying you and I, we sit down somewhere, you know, we're going to have a conversation. And then if we were to, like, turn the lights down and then have a nice meal and have a bottle of cider and light some candles, that just suddenly got a really nice situation, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the meal suddenly is tasting better and seeming better because of the whole package of that thing together.
Sure.
You know, if we're sitting at a bus stop and we have that same meal, you know, glaring traffic going by, it's going to be completely different.
Absolutely.
Different. So in my mind, you have to know how to make a beautiful cider and awareness of that from all the reasons I said before, and then go ahead and do the other things, because then the quality of that will be unbelievably good. Most of the time, I find when people do things, it's very ham-fisted, it's very heavy-handed, it's very, they're trying to be like iconoclastic and this and that. You know, I'd be like, okay, but let me taste your straight ciders. And most of the time, I don't find straight ciders that are making that are that good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I can see this is a quick way or interesting way, you know, or you don't want to peg yourself into this, you know, old fuddy-duddy, you know, traditional style. We want to make a new thing for ourselves. It's kind of like a kid with a red mohawk. You know, at some point you're going to grow up and shave the mohawk. You know what I mean? When you become an adult, when you have kids. Maybe. Mm-hmm. Maybe you're not.
But we have seen that a little bit in the craft beer industry where, you know, people were making beer.
How much more hops can we put in?
Or mediocre beer, and they would kind of mask it with flavoring and things like that. And I'm not saying people...
That being said, the best flavored ones are the ones that are from people who really know how to make stuff. And those I enjoy.
The best flavored ones.
Yeah. The best things that have things going on in them are ones that are balanced and good. You go like, wow.
Yeah.
Huh. That's really good and interesting. Yeah. I have no problem with those.
But you have to start from that base point.
It's usually a crutch.
Right.
That and a lot of residual sugar on the back end.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also another crutch, because I think that's the biggest flaw I see in most ciders. They're either too bone dry and stark and just bracing in a way that's not really good. Or they're overly sweet because they don't know how to get the body and the mouthfeel and the complexity without adding the sugar back in the back end.
Right. So that piece here, because a lot of ciders, like you said, go bone dry.
Yeah.
So you have that.
Now what? Now what?
Yeah. They're like, okay, I got the yeast. I had a good temperature for fermentation. It's not really hot.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to do a slow fermentation, not putting it next to the wood stove.
Mm-hmm.
I have a nice spot in my closet or in my basement.
Yep.
Or even at the cidery that's kind of redone their horse barn or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's going bone dry, and they're like, I don't know what to do. Where do they start if they don't want it to go completely bone dry? I mean, there's keeving, right? That's a different
beast.
But
and that's one way. But even
or stopping fermentation.
But I mean, all the keeving is really doing, you know, in general, is basically slowing down the inevitable.
Well, they're
over time
with
you're
a
still
low
gonna.
Nutrient.
Right. What I'm saying is that something still will go in that, you know, down the line. I mean,
it's alive. It's live.
Yeah.
It's not.
Yeah.
They're doing bottle.
Which is fine. But I mean, in Normandy and stuff, it's the thing is you're buying the cider and then it's alive and everyone knows this, and they're saying how do you like the cider, you know? It's like, oh, I like it, you know, a little bit sweet. They say, oh, okay, then drink it soon, and then
it'll change
if you want. Yeah.
Yes.
And they keep it in the fridge and drink it soon.
Yes.
Like, oh, I like it more dry. Okay, leave it out for 2 weeks or so, in a month, then take a look at it.
Right.
It's
changes.
Well, there's a constant process.
Sure.
Unless they stabilize it in the back end and they filter it.
Right.
That's a reality. It just slows down the reality. And so for me, and even then, the guarantee of cold, this is what blew my mind, is that I pulled stuff off of tanks and I had juice. I pulled juice off of the tanks and I put it in my fridge at 30, 35 degrees in my fridge. And I came back, it was in the back of my fridge, it's been in there for a year. You know, I came back cleaning out samples. My wife's like, you know, when are you going to get all these samples? Because I put out, like, people send me stuff. I try it and I pop it in there and I, you know, move on to something else. Mm-hmm. So there's literally probably 12 various size bottles just tucked all throughout the fridge. Mm-hmm. And she's like, clear this crap out. You know, I'm like, all right, all right.
I know that feeling.
Yeah. And so I pull it out and it was Melissa, and I opened it and it went, psst.
Yeah.
It literally fermented dry and carbonated itself at 36 degrees.
Wow.
So I'm like, and that's not supposed to happen, right?
Yeah.
Supposed to happen. So that's my mind is that nature is very powerful. Mm-hmm. So I know you're saying things, saying like, well, how do I stop this? I go, well, unless the real answer is that unless you are SO2ing and sterile filtering, you're not.
Mm-hmm.
You can delay it.
So kind of resign yourself to that. And
sure. And then understand what you're working with and knowing that that's the way it's been forever until, you know, the technology of the past, I don't know, what, 30 years or whatever hell it is, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, on the small scale, the small guys, you do have to spend a chunk of money to do it, but you can do it. You know, if you want to do it on a carboy scale, you absolutely can.
Right.
But it costs. That's the thing. And so most amateur people don't want to spend that money on it. And I think that's perfectly fine. So then what you would wind up doing on the back end, you know, cold crash it, you know, in a fridge.
Right.
Rack it up to drop as much load as possible. You know, if you're open to sulfites, I would recommend that. You know, from this and at that point, you know, go ahead and bottle it and keep it in the fridge and enjoy it. As it's going.
As it's going along and watch it change.
Yeah, yeah. And that's right. that's also
the beauty of it.
Well, exactly, because it will change it and if you do the things right and you were clean up front, you'll see an evolution of something and that's why I go back to the fact that this is wine and not beer. Because if done right, where were you at? What you should see, you know, for cider is like with any good wines, is that there is multiple chapters to the book. You know, what you had in the beginning will not be in a month, within another month, up to two. I've got ciders now that 2 years, and I'm still enjoying them for where they are now compared
to absolutely.
You know, phenomenal.
Yeah,
phenomenal.
Yeah, yeah.
So this thought of like, oh, it's so fast and going there, but I've also stabilized and filtered and stuff on my end,
mm-hmm.
you know, so there's that reality of that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as that thing towards, to me, you know, as good as beer is, it's a pamphlet.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to, I mean, it's amazing how all those parts go together, but it will not change too much from where it's, or it shouldn't.
Right.
You know, and that's why wine is wine and beer is beer, you know, because there's just more going on and for a longer period of time. So I actually think that that's beautiful. I embrace it.
I suspect that your cup is a bit fuller from listening to this chat. It was a fantastic time with Shay. He gave a lot. He was working hard. And we were kind of mulling over all these little different aspects. And I think he brought out some very specific things that I thought was quite interesting in terms of his view of cider as a wine, really trying to get people to kind of embrace that. I have my own thoughts about that, true. But, you know, this is what he does, and so it's always nice to hear different aspects of that. And I'm not sure what Pear feels about being called a pear cider. I don't think he really agrees, but, you know, after all, he is Pear. But that, again, is Shay's prerogative. He could go for it, and that's what he's doing. Look, he has a lot of mentions here in this chat. Go to the show notes, episode 73. And you'll be able to get some of the links to what we were specifically talking about and going to those particular yeast that he was mentioning to use for cider making. And if you are a patron of Cider Chat via Cider Chat's Patreon page, there is an extra bonus audio clip for patrons over 30 minutes that will be covering yeast nutrient and wild yeast, and then 3 specific tips for cider makers. So that is even more like whammy, really juicy stuff to delve into. So look for that link going up later this week for patrons. Thank you so much to all of you, specifically Current Cider of Pennsylvania, who has been part of the Cider Chat Going Up campaign page since the beginning. They are amazing supporters, and they're just cranking it out down there in Pennsylvania. So when you are out and about, always make sure to ask for Current Cider. By supporting them, you get amazing cider, and you also help to support this chat. Now, we have one more little piece here that I want to share with you. It came in from the United States Association of Cider Makers. So if you are a member of that, there's two webinars coming up. The first is taking place April 5th, so that is next week. And this is on cider trends in the U.S., how to increase your odds of success by evaluating marketplace dynamics. And I'm keenly interested in this, so I do plan on listening to this. This was part of the presentation that took place at CiderCon, and I didn't get to attend, so I'm psyched that they're putting this up as a webinar. So look forward to that. It's going to be really looking at some major data. And then coming up on April 13th is the apple of my eye, how to develop a cider packaging that wins with consumers. Packaging, branding, all that stuff, any way to market yourself is important. So if you are part of the United States Association of Cider Makers, and you should be, whether you're a cider enthusiast or you are a producer or not, or a startup, you know, there's a lot of great ways that they are serving the industry, and this is just one of them. So you could find that link in the show notes to find out more about that webinar. Well, all right now, Ciderville, we did it. We learned a lot this week. We had fun and shared yet another good glass of cider over some good chit-chat. It is just so perfect. So, until next week, I hope your cup remains full and you stay happy, healthy, and engaged out in Ciderville. This is Rhea Windcaller signing off for now. Looking forward to seeing you in Ciderville.
Yeehaw!